You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 4th of December 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Phil Hahn, and Guy Delaney.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we'll be setting the day's agenda with Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute. What do you have, Shashank?
We've got Iran, we have got Pakistan, and we've got Vice President Joe Biden's trip to Asia.
More from Shashank in just a moment. Also, protesters pledge to tighten their grip on key government buildings in the Ukraine. We'll see who will blink first.
Plus, we'll be looking at the increasing role of Western intervention across Africa.
So much for the rapid intervention, but of course in the long term, the reason for the Malian crisis was poor governance, was the fact that jihadists, but also extremely corrupt drug dealers and others were able to get a foothold in the country.
And a fancy, a carefully crafted briefcase, or maybe a 1920s tennis racket. Well, you can now head online for some upscale shopping.
But if you want a business to have any opportunity to succeed, there are three lenses that you need to stare through. One being viability. Is there a workable business model? Two, desirability. Do people want it? And the third is feasibility. Is it technologically possible to pull off?
All that, and perhaps an Italian musical interlude to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
So a very busy Wednesday edition of the program. It's just coming up to 2 minutes past the hour. We'll get started in just a moment. But before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. The US Secretary of State John Kerry has urged the Ukrainian government to listen to its people after President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to spurn a pact with the European Union sparked mass protests. NATO foreign ministers have condemned the use of excessive force against protesters in Kiev and urged all sides to refrain from provoking further clashes. At the weekend, police used batons and stun grenades to break up pro-Europe protests. Mr. Kerry said Ukrainians had demonstrated in unbelievable numbers.
We urge the Ukrainian government to listen to the voices of its people who want to live in freedom and in opportunity and prosperity. And we urge all sides to conduct themselves peacefully. Violence has no place in a modern European state.
The US military says it stopped ground cargo shipments from Afghanistan via Pakistan because of the risk to drivers following protests over drone attacks. Pentagon spokesman said the decision would affect shipments of equipment and other items leaving US bases in Afghanistan, but he said deliveries could be resumed in the near future. Pakistani protesters have blocked the main US supply route to Afghanistan in protest at civilian deaths blamed on drones. The US Vice President Joe Biden has arrived in Beijing, where he's expected to discuss China's new air defense zone with the country's leaders. The US is one of many countries which have criticized Beijing's decision to introduce the zone above disputed islands in the East China Sea. Ahead of Mr. Biden's visit, one of China's leading state-run newspapers warned that he should not expect any substantial headway if he comes simply to repeat his government's previous erroneous and one-sided remarks. Alcohol tests conducted on the driver of a New York commuter train that derailed on Sunday, killing four people, show he had not been drinking. The seven-car train was travelling at 82 miles an hour when it crashed nearly three times the speed limit. Reports on Tuesday suggested the driver told investigators he lost focus and went into a daze shortly before the crash. Earl Wiener from the National Transportation Safety Board said other safety tests had been carried out.
We also looked at the data for each of the station stops along the route and saw no anomalies or degradation of the braking performance as the trip went along. Simply put, based on these data, there's no indication that the brake systems were not functioning properly.
12 million voters are going to the polls in Delhi in elections that will have a huge impact on the Indian National Assembly. The representatives to the 70-member assembly will be elected with the results issued at the weekend. Natasha Cole is a Kashmiri novelist and academic. She told us that the election is going to be watched very carefully because of a new contender.
apart from the main, the usual bipolar contest between the Congress Party, which is, you know, the party of power in Delhi, and the BJP, which is the right-wing Hindu nationalist party, there's a third entrant in the main contenders. This third entrant is a party called the Aam Aadmi Party, which literally translates into the party of the common man. And this party has had a lot of support on the wave of anti-corruption protests.
The Indian writer Manil Suri has won the Literary Review Bad Sex Prize for a sex scene in his third novel, The City of Devi. The scene is set in a Mumbai under curfew, facing the threat of a nuclear bomb, and it features a woman, her physicist husband, and a young gay man. The book's publishers urge readers to take the book to bed with them to discover sex scenes described in the Times Literary Supplement as unfettered, quirky, beautiful, tragic, and wildly experimental. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks, Barney. I can think of a few people whom that description would suit to a T.
I'll have an extract after the headlines.
Sounds like a Saturday night.
Maybe in your part of town.
And moving swiftly on, it seems to be 6 minutes past 8 o'clock here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
It is time now to set the day's news agenda, and with three of the big stories that will be setting that agenda, we're now joined in the studio by Shashank Joshi of the Royal United Services Institute think tank here in London. Shashank, lovely to see you as
Morning.
Always. Vice President Joe Biden on his tour of Asia. Of course, he was in Japan just yesterday. He's touched down in China, perhaps the trickiest part of that trip.
Yeah, I think he came to Beijing hoping to rescue the U.S. pivot to Asia. Obviously, President Obama had to cancel a major trip to Asia a few months ago for the government shutdown back in the U.S., prompting people to say, how can the U.S. possibly save Asia when its own government is in tatters? And he was hoping to talk about things like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, big trade agreements, climate change. And he ends up mired in this issue of China's air defense identification zone, where in Beijing, it's easy. His message was simply, we support you. China has changed the status quo. China is taking a risk in Asia and stood by an ally, which is a little bit concerned. In Beijing, he has to work out something very difficult indeed. How does he deter China from actually making the zone active and scrambling more fighter jets? And more importantly, the US hasn't asked China to roll back this zone. Japan has. So how does he then say, contain the influence of this zone over the longer term, making sure it doesn't become a legal fact without asking China to do something it just won't do?
And what's the approach of the Beijing government likely to be? Because we've seen in the past that they hardly gave an enormous amount of respect to Barack Obama when he made his first visit there. Now his deputy is going. What sort of welcome awaits him?
Well, I think the Chinese realize the last time they pulled a stunt like this and upped the temperature in the South China Sea and the East China Sea in 2010, declaring it a core interest. The effect was easy. They united Asia against them. They pushed countries into the arms of the United States. It was a huge foreign policy cock-up, and it undercut this image of China as a grand strategic power that we like to ascribe to the Politburo. I think the Chinese will realize they've gone too far. I think they're trying to fudge the issue. They can't back down completely, but they are trying to say, look, we won't be scrambling aircraft all the time. We won't be making undue demands on these planes. They're trying to find a compromise, I think. But longer term, the concern will be, have they established a fact on the ground? Was that their aim? And if so, how can the other countries of the region slowly push this back with American help? But I think this has to be seen in the context of countries like Japan, South Korea, Indonesia, looking at America and judging America in the context of all these suggestions of declining U.S. power and declining U.S. reliability, particularly in the Middle East.
And of course, this is an issue for China trying to emerge itself as the dominant power, perhaps not just in the region, but across the entire world. Do you think this is a case of China, in a sense, almost just testing the waters, so to speak, seeing how far they can push the boundaries, what they can get away with, and seeing perhaps, just how much dominance they can really exert without, you know, getting caught out for it.
I think that's a very valuable hypothesis. We can't really distinguish between two explanations, one of which is that we've just had a major party conference. The leadership has promised China a new place in the world, more stature. And this is testing the waters, as you say. The other explanation, perhaps more concerning, is that this is parts of the PLA, the People's Liberation Army, freelancing. Of course, which sounds pretty terrifying. Mm. We don't know. I would lean towards this is a coherent act of Xi Jinping and his state, but we just don't know. And certainly in the past, with naval clashes, there's been suggestions the PLA Navy has been up to things off its own leash.
Is it a good idea for China to become more militarily or strategically involved in this way? Because we've seen them in the past profit from getting involved in businesses in places like Iraq, while other countries are busily mired in these military confrontations there.
Well, China has been the master free rider of efforts in Iraq and Afghanistan. It's sitting there investing huge amounts in mines in Afghanistan without paying a single penny towards the last 12 years of fighting or supporting the Afghan forces. So what a great approach. It will continue that if it can. In Asia, though, everything is different. This is a core interest. And let's not forget here, from China's point of view, they didn't cause this crisis. Japan caused this crisis by nationalizing the islands last year and changing the status quo, bring them under government control, and then upping the temperature. So from China's point of view, and I think with some validity here, you know, we're not the only culpable parties. Japan has caused this as well, and then goes and hides behind the Americans and says, look what the Chinese have done. Get on our side. And for the US, here's another interesting point of, you know, problem. How do you reassure allies without writing them a blank check? That's the eternal dilemma of strong parties and alliances.
And more dilemmas for the US when it comes to Afghanistan and Pakistan.
An even worse ally here. You know, Pakistan, the ally from hell, frankly, repeatedly holding us upside down to shake us for all we have periodically. Now, on this occasion, you have to remember here, the US has put $33 billion worth of equipment into Afghanistan over all the years of fighting. Mm. It's going to leave about $7 billion. The rest has to come out. This is expensive stuff to shift. And Pakistan, and particularly a troublesome politician, Imran Khan of the PTI, whose party now runs Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, the province in the northwest abutting the tribal areas, used to be called the Northwest Frontier Province, has allowed vigilantes, of course, you know, giving them free rein, to go torch and block NATO convoys coming out. Now, the US can still take stuff out from a southern crossing point in Balochistan, but up north that's been blocked off. And so the US now, a year away from withdrawal, with masses of stuff to get out, if you put all of their containers end to end, it would stretch 400 miles, now has yet another delay. And it's not clear what they can do to resolve this.
Well, perhaps they could address what people are angry about, which is these drone attacks.
Indeed. But what's interesting is Imran Khan, first of all, is at odds with the government. So the Pakistani government has tacitly sanctioned most of the drone attacks. They can't say so in public, and often they will echo Khan's rhetoric. But the other point is, by their own figures, the Pakistani Interior Ministry's figures released about 2 months ago, there have been zero civilian deaths in the past 2 years from drone strikes. Do I believe that? Not entirely. But what's interesting is those are the Pakistani government's own figures. The point is, the US has been slowly tapering off drone strikes, but it is concerned. We'll be gone in a year's time. We may lose all our Afghan bases if mad Mr. Hamid Karzai has his way. And so we've better get in all the terrorist hunting we can before the 12 months is out, because we will have nowhere to run the drones from after that. So I think they can't really address this point, because Imran Khan at this point is simply blindly parroting whatever the Taliban are saying in an effort to win populist
win
extremist votes.
Absolutely. And finally, Shashank, another interesting story, a bit of a testing water, so to speak, of a new power play perhaps in the Middle East when it comes to Iran.
Absolutely. We all know the states of the Gulf monarchies don't like Iran. They don't like its meddling. They don't like its support for Shia minorities. And I think what we're seeing now is a charm offensive by this new Iranian government. You know, these guys are good at diplomacy. The foreign minister, a smooth US educated man, we saw him in Geneva, is in Qatar, Kuwait and Oman in an effort to say, look, don't worry, we may have tied up this agreement with the US, but we're not about to gobble you up. And I think this is a very, very sensible move by Iran.
Does Iran have the capability to gobble anybody up?
No, not at all. What it does have the ability to do is make trouble, sponsor forces within these countries, as it's always done, historically with Shia communities. These countries are also worried about Iran's role in backing Assad's forces in Syria. So I think Iran now, it knows these countries are terrified that the nuclear deal is step one, and step three is a grand US-Iran bargain, which sees all these Arab monarchies out in the cold. And Iran's job will be to say, look, we respect you, we're not just going to turn around and bite you, and it's trying to make sure it can build on the nuclear deal and enhance its presence in the region, not alarm too many people. In other words, it's doing what China isn't doing.
It's a fascinating time to be looking into that part of the world. Shashank Joshi, many thanks for joining us on the program. Shashank Joshi from the Royal United Services Institute here on Midori House. In just a moment, we'll be checking in with our woman in Bamako. Back after this.
Monocle 24 takes to the road once more this week as the globalist packs up its headphones and heads east. Wednesday's show comes from the scenic setting of the roof terrace at the Gallery of Modern Art in Brisbane, where we'll be talking to the mayor of the city about his plans for the G20. Meanwhile, on Friday, the show pulls up a stool at the CSHH coffee shop in Singapore, where we'll sit down with the new director of the National Gallery of Art and the editors of Underscore magazine. All that and a lot more besides on The Globalist this week on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24. It's time now to check in with one of our correspondents around the globe, and we're spinning it now, and it's just landed on North Africa.
Well, a little earlier, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco caught up with our Bamako correspondent in Mali, Alex Duval-Smith. They started by talking about the Africa Security Summit taking place in Paris at the end of this week.
Yes, it's France convening most African countries and certainly the vast majority of the Francophone ones to discuss African security. Obviously, what springs to mind is the intervention in Mali earlier this year and the one upcoming in Central African Republic, to which France is deploying 1,000 troops. The idea that France wants to put across, or says it wants to put across, is that it's not the gendarme of Africa and there has to be collaboration, there has to be a collaborative security effort. And that, of course, will translate into French support for the upcoming African Rapid Intervention Force. But also, we hope for some explanation over what France's motives are, really, for the extent of its interventions in Africa.
What do these interventions mean for the recipient country?
Well, it depends. I mean, for Mali, it's been very clear. France came here to oust Islamists who were here, who had got settled in as a result of bad governance. And that's where it becomes a bit more complex. So the initial military operation, which is still ongoing, as a matter of fact, as France sent 4,500 troops in January, well, it still has 3,300 on the ground, which is far more than it projected it would have by this stage. So much for the rapid intervention. But of course, in the long term, the reason for the Malian crisis was poor governance, was the fact that jihadists, but also extremely corrupt drug dealers and others were able to get a foothold in the country. And those are issues that France says it wants to tackle with a bit more vigour in future, so that these crises don't keep reoccurring.
Where do you think this French presence in Mali is going?
It's going, well, I can tell you where Mali would like it to go. Well, ordinary Malians do not feel safe yet. Ordinary Malians dread the day France will withdraw. Ordinary Malians do not feel that their own army is up to the job of securing the borders of this huge country, neither equipment-wise nor in terms of organization and hierarchy. France, of course, cannot interminably be in Mali, and France is going to be looking, I'm sure, for a more cost-effective, lightweight manner of being here. One of the examples we've seen is that it has an operational unit inside every MINUSMA battalion. That's the UN force here. So if you take, for example, the Burkinabe presence in Timbuktu, there are between 25 and 40 French officers within that unit. The French would say they're not running it, but they're certainly keeping a very close eye. And that's a cost-effective, low personnel approach to a presence in Mali.
Alex, moving on to another topic, I mean, shall we discuss a little bit the implications of the MNLA's breach of ceasefire?
It's a difficult one to call. The Tuareg secessionist group, the National Movement for the Liberation of Azawad, on Friday announced that it was no longer going to respect the ceasefire that was agreed in June and which allowed Mali to hold presidential elections. The fact of the MNLA going back to war raises questions because the MNLA's military might is not that clear. The MNLA at different times has been supported by different outside forces. One regular, shall we say, supporter of the MNLA has been Algeria, but it's hard to read what Algeria is planning to do now with its support for the secessionists. We do believe they're not very, very strongly armed, but they do have diplomatic clout. And why do they have diplomatic clout? Because the MNLA, the Tuaregs in the desert, have been crucial as guides to the French during their military intervention here. So the French can't really drop them. At the same time, France is supporting the rebuilding of the Malian military. So I think we've got some very interesting times ahead where France essentially decides what its view is of the Tuareg secession.
And very bad news for Mali's prospects of stability as well, right?
Well, absolutely. There was a time at which the MNLA briefly, but nevertheless, allied with the Islamist rebels. And that certainly helped the secessionists advance over what they call Azawad, northern Mali. They do insist, the MNLA, that they are not an Islamist group by any stretch of the imagination, and that alliance was short-lived. But it goes to show that the secessionists are capable to go looking for support and looking to those who have the power to help them.
And finally, Alex, there's an interesting story here about donor aid in northern Mali. Can you tell us a little bit more?
Yeah, well, just in the last couple of days, Saudi Arabia has pledged $100 million development aid for northern Mali without giving very much in the way of details of how the money will be spent and saying that it's for the Malian government to decide. But of course, the rise of Islamism has been linked to the influence of Wahhabism in northern and especially northeastern Mali. So the return of Saudi Arabia is intriguing. Also, of course, Mali now, the post-war Mali, even though there's a strong military presence here, but if we talk of a country which now has an elected government, there's a sort of rush to be the first to deliver aid. The European Union earlier this year in May organised a donor conference at which 3.2 billion euros were pledged in Brussels in May. And that money is now on the point of being spent. And in fact, when you go around the country at the moment, you meet aid consultants working for various governments to advise on where development money could be spent. And then we've had recent interest shown by Morocco. Morocco has built a field hospital in the capital, Bamako. And so it does begin to feel like there's a lot of competition for helping Mali, which to someone like me is alarming because much, much, much aid money over the years has been badly misspent in this country and ended up in a few pockets. That's why this is still one of the poorest countries in the world.
Alex Duval-Smith there speaking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco from Bamako.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delaunay, and Phil Hahn. It's now just coming up to 9:24 in the morning in Rome. It's 08:24 here in London. And it's 10:24 in Ukraine's capital, Kiev, which is where we're heading now. Thousands of anti-government protesters are still on the streets there, despite freezing conditions. They're demanding the resignation of President Yanukovych. But the government survived a vote of no confidence in Parliament on Tuesday.
Protesters continue to receive support from abroad, however. NATO foreign ministers condemned the excessive force by security forces, and Secretary of State John Kerry urged the government to listen to the voices of the people. But with the promise by protesters to occupy government offices, who will end up blinking first? Well, joining us on the line from Kiev is Monocle's correspondent there, Gulliver Craig. Gulliver, welcome to the program. Protesters are still on the streets of Kiev, and we're hearing now reports that troops are being moved into the city as well. Bring us up to date.
We often hear these reports about troops being moved into the city. There's an atmosphere of great fear among protesters around here that there's going to be a violent crackdown. Yesterday, Prime Minister Mykola Azarov basically made a veiled threat of that sort of thing, saying that we've got enough force. But I think that the Ukrainian government, with all of these condemnations of the force that was used over the weekend, which, although it left more than 100 people injured, was quite isolated in a couple of areas of the whole sort of demonstration area. I think the Ukrainian government maybe does realize that it would be very, very, very bad in terms of the world's view of Ukraine if force were to be used again. So many of the world's journalists have arrived in Kiev yesterday. So I don't know whether or not we could expect force to be used. At the moment, protesters are kind of spread out all around the political district of Kiev on various different streets. Right now, I'm at the end of one street that leads to the parliament, and they've parked police buses with special forces representatives inside those buses to prevent protesters from getting anywhere near the parliament, which is supposed to be sitting this morning, but the opposition have said they'd block it.
That's been quite interesting with what the protesters are doing. You've got all the police moving in, but the protesters are prepared for this. And I was reading about all the precautions they've taken, and it sounds like something from the film Home Alone.
One thing that they did quite inventively is that they've made use of the freezing weather by, beside the barricades that they've set up all around Independence Square, they poured water on all around those barricades so that it's, sheet ice. So that anyone who's trying to come and get over those barricades, other than by the control points that they've got where people can get through if they're authorized to do so, as it were, by the demonstrators, as in if they're not police, then it's going to be very hard to, because it's going to be extremely slippery.
And Gulliver, all the while, the man at the center of this entire controversy, of course, is President Viktor Yanukovych, and he's just left the country, essentially he's flying to China on a trip there. What can you tell us about his role, and is he essentially just trying to keep his head down while he thinks, at least, or he hopes, this will die down?
It's possible that he's hoping that by being away when perhaps the worst of this, as it were, is happening, he'll be able to blame it all the more on his Prime Minister, Mykola Azarov, and his government, and that he might be able to return and do some kind of cabinet reshuffle or name a new Prime Minister, and that that would cause things to die down. I think he also decided to sort of take the stance of a statesman who is putting the country's best interests first and going to do important deals for Ukraine's economy in China, seeking investors and that kind of thing. I don't think that Mr. Yanukovych's opponents are really buying much of that rhetoric, though, because he is absolutely here seen as a greedy, corrupt individual whose main interest in being president of Ukraine is in order to enrich himself and his family. I mean, that's the perception of him almost even among those who aren't protesting at all and who even might think that he's the best of a bad bunch. I mean, it's his. There are very few Ukrainians you can find who have a high view of President Yanukovych.
Now, the protesters have taken over some significant buildings in the centre of Kiev. They've taken over parts of City Hall and the trade union building, various other places. What does this mean in terms of, I suppose, this war of attrition between the protesters and the security authorities? Are they going to be able to affect some sort of change by blocking significant city and even state functions?
I think that the occupation of the City Hall is not something that the main leadership of the opposition are really all that happy about. It was the initiative of a rogue group, as it were, of nationalistic demonstrators who've mainly been just using it as a place to keep warm and get something to eat and spend some time. The real headquarters, as it were, of the protest movement that's been set up on Independence Square is, as you mentioned, in the trade union building. But that was given to them. They didn't have to come and take it over. The trade unions are absolutely on side and trying to organize a general strike. And what the protesters are trying to do in other places is not take over or storm government buildings, but block access to them and picket them everywhere. I should mention, though, that there's another picket that's been set up today by pro-government supporters. I believe some of these people are paid to be there, but there are people who are against the Ukrainian opposition much more than they're against the government. They don't like the opposition political parties. They don't like the idea of this association agreement with the European Union, and they've come in from the south and east of Ukraine to protest as well in favour of the government.
And Gulliver, just finally, many people, of course, comparing these protests to the 2004 Orange Revolution. Do you think that is a fair comparison?
it's a comparison that you cannot avoid making, because I think in the atmosphere there's a lot of similarities. Music on the square, people are spending all night, tents out there. But there are two very important differences. One, sadly, is that while the Orange Revolution was an entirely peaceful affair, this already has not been. And the other big difference is that the Orange Revolution saw protesters coming out on the streets and basically chanting the name of one man, Viktor Yushchenko, who they thought had been unfairly deprived of victory in the presidential election, and they wanted to see him elected president. Now, the slogans are much more varied. It's behind a vague idea of European integration, which I think that Ukrainians have quite a lot of different ideas between them of what that might mean. And the political parties that the different protesters here support are very heterically, very different. A lot of big differences between the different forces that the protesters here are more or less members of.
So not necessarily a unified opposition there on the streets of Kiev. Gulliver Craig, many thanks for joining us from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev.
In the next half hour of the programme, we'll be discussing literary freedom around the world, and we'll take to the web to see why we're going upscale online.
People need, either by design or by default, to purchase products that telegraph a message about who they are today or the person they someday aspire to be. None of the things that many of us today love to buy, love to see, love to read, were routinely appearing in the likes of GQ, Esquire, Details.
But first, here's Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Guy. The U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has urged the Ukrainian government to listen to its people after President Viktor Yanukovych's decision to spurn a pact with the European Union sparked mass protests. NATO foreign ministers have condemned the use of excessive force against protesters in Kiev. The U.S. military says it stopped ground cargo shipments from Afghanistan via Pakistan because of the risk to drivers following protests over drone attacks. Pakistani protesters have blocked the main U.S. supply route in protest at civilian deaths blamed on drones. The U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has arrived in Beijing, where he's expected to discuss China's new air defense zone with the country's leaders. The U.S. is one of many countries which have criticized Beijing's decision to introduce the zone above disputed islands in the East China Sea. Alcohol tests conducted on the driver of a New York commuter train that derailed on Sunday, killing four people, show he had not been drinking. Reports on Tuesday suggested the driver told investigators he lost focus and went into a daze shortly before the crash. 12 million voters are going to the polls in Delhi in elections that will have a huge impact on the Indian National Assembly. Representatives to the 70-member assembly will be elected. The results will be out at the weekend. The Indian writer Manil Suri has won the Literary Review Bad Sex Prize for a sex scene in his third novel, The City of Devi. The Times Literary Supplement had previously described the sex scenes as unfettered, quirky, beautiful, tragic and wildly experimental. And I have a tantalising morsel here for you. Surely supernovas explode that instant somewhere in some galaxy. The hut vanishes, and with it the sea and the sands. Only Karun's body, locked with mine, remains. We streak like superheroes past suns and solar systems. We dive through shoals of quarks and atomic nuclei. In celebration of our breakthrough fourth star, statisticians the world over rejoice. Well, I can see the windows are steaming up, so I'll go and have a cold shower.
Who needs Dorian Gray when you have Barney Burnham?
Exactly. I had a Thai meal last night which did that.
Anyways, let's move on.
Mentori,
are you lost?
I'm quite lost in the screen.
You're turning a bit red.
Do you know, I've lost my focus. You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Guy Delaunay, and Phil Hahn.
Now we will turn to this week's edition of The Entrepreneurs. We're going to be meeting Michael Phillips Moskowitz. Michael is the founder of the exceedingly popular Bureau of Trade, an online marketplace of carefully chosen objects for men, from clothes and tennis rackets to briefcase and motorcycles. Well, the site's a fantastic place to waste hours and drain your bank account rather quickly. And Michael now has a new partner in that endeavor. He's just sold the company to eBay.
Well, the show's producer, Daniel Giacopelli, sat down with Michael recently to discuss his eclectic entrepreneurial journey from Middle East analyst and clothing label curator to magazine founder and, yes, mountain mascot.
I was suffering from, in the parlance of our times, a very severe breakup. Was contemplating the notion of going back to graduate school yet again, fully intending to do so, only to come down from the mountains and get a job at IDEO.
What did you want to do that degree in?
I wanted to get an MBA, and IDEO became an MBA that I didn't pay for, that paid me, and exposed me to some of the things that, frankly, proved invaluable to the work that we did on Bureau of Trade. So it was about human-centered design. It was about teasing out, identifying or catering to, even creating ideas that address latent needs and unmet desires. I think that, you know, it's one thing. I think they have a pretty authoritative lens that I still champion and celebrate, which is that if you want a business to have any opportunity to succeed, there are three lenses that you need to stare through. One being viability. Is there a workable business model? Two, desirability. Do people want it? And the third is feasibility. Is it technologically possible to pull off? If it meets any of those three criteria, I think the prospects of long-term success, assuming that you can zealously prosecute your agenda with pathological focus, are quite promising. Absent pathology and absent those three lenses, I wish you good luck.
So did you have the idea for Bureau of Trade when you were still at IDEO?
I did. I mean, we started running a series of experiments. I knew that I wanted to do something that made people learn and made people laugh and made people lust. So it was a joke one Saturday night. A friend at IDEO, a very talented MIT designer who's a stunningly good-looking guy, but doesn't have it within him to be a womanizer, was having an all-too-brief falling out with his girlfriend, and he wondered out loud, what would Matthew McConaughey do? And I said, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard, but that would make an amazing website. And so I wanted to distill the essence of the torso from Texas, assuming that he read Schopenhauer and Heidegger, and tell the world, you know, basically ask or answer the world's questions. And so psychopaths from all over planet Earth to the tune of 15,000 a day were and it was more than I knew what to do with. The Huffington Post voted it the number one best way to waste time at work. That wasn't exactly a plaudit that I was searching for, and it wasn't what I wanted to do.
I do remember that.
Oh, you saw that?
I did.
Sheer horror. Sorry, it was horrifying. And then I came to him one Saturday night and said, I just want to do something at the intersection of content and commerce. And he said, well, so why don't you do that? And I thought, yeah, that's what I should do. So I went away to a dear friend's bachelor party in Reykjavik, Adam Rich from Thrillist. And I sat around the table with him and several other VCs and sort of media mavens in New York. And several themes emerged. One was that they were all married men with girlfriends. I had no such distraction. Two, they are real bon vivants. And that's fine. I celebrate them for it. But I don't drink. I'm a teetotaler. And third, many things in the men's lifestyle space were utterly undifferentiated. And again, this is not a critique of any of their products, which I think have been a stunning success. This is simply saying that as a voracious reader of magazines, as somebody who still reveres many of the things that you'll find in print and online, I wasn't finding enough of what I wanted. And it wasn't because I thought that my opinion mattered so much. It was that the world, there's been a tectonic shift, that it's not just about stuff anymore. People need, either by design or by default, to purchase products that telegraph a message about who they are today or the person they someday aspire to be. That was one. Two, none of the things that many of us today love to buy, love to see, love to read, were routinely appearing in the likes of GQ, Esquire, Details, The Rake, pre-owned luxury items. Let's take luxury entirely out of the equation. Things that you can afford and still love and will likely cherish for a lifetime. The publishing calendar didn't permit them to cover eBay and Craigslist, and we were beginning to witness more and more curated experiences online. These were early days at Pinterest. These were early, I mean, there were countless other examples that were starting to bubble up, and I thought, look, if I can make you learn something every day, which I think is an important and primordial motivation, but we want to be smarter, and I can make you laugh to make you feel more human because you live in such a jaded, cynical, you know, relentlessly grinding daily routine, then maybe I can earn your permission to make you lust after things that really matter. So in essence, we were borrowing a page from The Daily Show's playbook. He took a disenchanted audience of 20-somethings, Jon Stewart and his enviable production team, including Steve Botto, who's a dear friend and actually now one of my advisors. And he curated the news. He coated it in a comedic veneer and made it not just palatable, he made it addictive. And that disenchanted audience of 20-somethings are now some of the most passionate followers of contemporary American politics, shockingly enough. I thought we could do the same thing for products rather than politics. So that was basically the motivation for the Bureau.
And then where did you go from there? How did the Bureau get founded? What did you do? Where did you get investment?
Right. So I put in every penny I had, which were very few pennies. I think I had $3,000 in my bank account. And through persuasion and a bit of manipulation and relentless cajoling and arm twisting and begging and pleading, I got the best designers I know to sort of sit in on these design sprints. They weren't design summits, they were design sprints. So I'd get them to steal away for a weekend, hold up either at IDEO or another office space, and we'd whiteboard everything. And then I found this wunderkid 18-year-old who was the youngest intern. True, and by intern, I don't mean a coffee fetcher. I mean an interaction designer that was being paid. But we've never had somebody that. These are 24 and 25-year-old veteran, experienced, sometimes venerated designers from other firms. He was amazing. And I persuaded him to work feverishly in our collective service for this grand vision. And he bought in. And then I went around to friends and family and hat in hand, asked for $5,000 a piece. And I think based on prior experience, knowing that when I'm possessed by a vision like this, absolutely nothing will get in my way. And I was willing to sacrifice everything. And so they generously gave me $5,000 a piece. And that then would have bought me, by staying at IDEO and spending very, 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 very carefully, 6 or 8 months of operating time. We launched the site on February 2nd, and 2 weeks later, I had a deal in hand from VCs. Now, that might sound a bit out of the ordinary. Here's how it went. I strategically recruited a series of advisors that either had deep ties within the VC community or were very experienced operators, and they proved profoundly valuable.
And this was out in California?
It was. So I was living then in the peninsula.
When was this?
In 2011. That's when, the idea occurred to me in 2011. The site launched on February 2nd, 2012, and a year later we were acquired by eBay.
That was Michael Phillips Moskowitz there, founder of the Bureau of Trade with Monocle's Danny Giacopelli. Well, you can hear more on that program, plus a bevy of other interviews from a Spanish hot air balloon service to a Tunisian furniture company. That's all coming up tonight at 1900 hours London time, 1400 hours in New York City.
You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this with a look at literary freedom around the world.
This Christmas, gather up your elves, load up the sleigh, and head to Midori House for our annual Christmas fair. We'll be hosting our favourite nations and retailers, mixing up Swiss Weihnachten and Japanese Kurisumasu with traditional Yuletide cheer. You can stock up on Christmas presents for your loved ones, pet our reindeer, enjoy performances from our musical guests. You can even meet our Finnish VIP, Santa Claus. It's all happening at Midori House at 1 Dorset Street from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. on the 7th and 8th of December.
You're listening to Midori House. The time is just coming up to 8:42 here in London. You know, Phil, talking about Japanese kurisumasu, my favourite and possibly apocryphal tale from a Tokyo department store, this is maybe 20 or 30 years ago, was okay. They wanted to do a seasonal display in their window, and they ended up with Father Christmas nailed to a cross.
Oh, lost in translation.
I think it was. Yeah. Now, moving swiftly on, we're going to continue with a look at the borders of freedom of speech and literary freedom. Now, PEN Slovakia is an organisation which promotes freedom of expression, but 4 years ago, it condemned the publication of a poetry book. And why was that? The poetry happened to be written by wartime Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic, who's now on trial for genocide in The Hague.
Well, this is an example of cases that led our next guest to try to define the limits of freedom to write and the freedom to publish. Well, she joins us now in the studio. Author of Literary Freedom, A Cultural Right to Literature, Heather Catherine McRobbie. Welcome to the program,
Thank
Heather.
You. Thank
so the book
me.
Is out in 2 weeks.
Yes,
and this
that's
was all
right.
pegged. Was this initially, I guess, inspired from that case that Guy was talking about with PEN Slovakia?
Yes, that's right. I was living in Sarajevo at the time when this case came up, and I thought it was very indicative of the problematic ways we currently have of thinking about freedom of expression. When we had this freedom of expression organization like PEN issuing a statement in favor of censorship, then something sort of jars there just philosophically. So I thought it's important for us to find a new way to think about the whole issue.
I know that you've got a chapter specifically on the Karadzic issue in your book. You know, without giving too much away, because we wouldn't want to spoil the pleasure for readers, but, you know, which side do you come down on? Do you think that it was incorrect of PEN Slovakia to suggest it should be banned?
Not to waffle too much, but I try to construct a position in defence of freedom of expression, which I think really is one of the, you know, central sort of key defences for anyone approaching something from a sort of a human rights perspective or the perspective of personal freedom and personal liberty, but one that recognises the harm caused by hate speech. And I would say that Karadzic's poetry is hate speech, even though it is implicit and it's coded and it's metaphorical, because, you know, poetry is not the same as, you know, a newspaper article or a broadcast sort of outwardly spreading sort of hate hate speech or racist propaganda, but...
Are you adopting a sort of Zola-esque approach on this? I despise what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it.
It's more to do with a little, but I try and kind of move away from... It's sort of J.S. Mill is the big sort of negative liberty guy who is sort of saying, you have a right to say anything up until the point where it harms someone else. But it's very sort of laissez-faire. So you just leave writers to write until it sort of juts up to this point. And I want to say, well, there's a different way of thinking about this, which is to do with the writer in society and a sort of symbiotic relationship between the writer and the society and the importance of maintaining that relationship in a healthy way, which is really good because it stops us always trying to, like, discern this line, which is impossible. I mean, where do you draw the line?
And I guess the question is always, who's the one that makes the decision of what's right
exactly.
and what's wrong? You know, it's a very fine line there, and one person's definition of what goes too far, what's appropriate, is completely different to another person's.
Exactly. And what I found really interesting is literature and art smudges it even more because it's so coded and it's often so allegorical. Well, I mean, where would you, do you draw the line at, you know, Wagner? Do you draw the line at Shylock? I mean, there are ways of reading art and literature that if we took a sort of literalist approach, we'd end up continually like redrawing the boundaries. So I try and actually make a case for freedom of expression, but one that recognises the harm caused by sort of racist or exclusivist or other forms of depictions by instead promoting like a multiplicity of voices, because I think that is how you diffuse the sort of the power that something like Carriage, which is very hateful and very bad, by the way, very bad poetry, it's really naff, to stop it sort of operating is to provide a platform for alternative voices that kind of diffuse its power in society.
Well, talking about bad literature, you also bring up Salman Rushdie.
That's been nice.
No, really, he's rancid, I think. But there we are. That's an opinion. Now, if I was sitting in judgment, we'd have different views of Salman Rushdie. But of course, there was the famous Satanic Verses issue, and some people, I mean, if they have hold a particular faith, they would argue in their way that there was hate speech within that book, and yet, through a different lens, to use a phrase that we've heard on Monocle already today, it looks completely different.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think the Rushdie case, whatever you think of the Satanic Verses, which very few people have actually read. People talk about it.
I got to page 100 and lost the will to live.
But I think it's also a good way to sort of delineate between something like, I would say, Karadzic's poetry, and also I look at Leni Riefenstahl on the one hand, and literature that's offensive. And I do think that is something we should keep from, you know, J.S. Mill and all these good old liberals who do all the boundaries on this stuff, is that you might be very offended by Rushdie, but he is not inciting harm against anyone. Karadzic's poetry and Leni Riefenstahl's filmmaking are making derogatory depictions in a way that and stirring up sentiments that incite harm. And I think that that's an important distinction we need to get, because then you could be offended by anything, aren't you?
Well, how do you think that the argument and the discussion points about freedom of literature and of free expression has kind of evolved in the last 5-10 years? And I mainly, of course, just thinking about just off the top of my head, of course, what's been happening online. So many more outlets for people to voice their opinions, no matter what other people may think of it. And of course, with no real censorship laws online, They're much more free, aren't they?
It's interesting because we seem to have a lot of kind of different debates going on with freedom of expression. They're all really imperative, but the dots aren't really being joined, because on the one hand, we do have, you know, things like the threats on Twitter or, you know, against female journalists, or being one recent example, also a lot of nationalistic hate speech from various groups. And then we also have surveillance of the internet. So on the one hand, we feel this, you know, instinct to be like, oh, well, you know, people are making hate speech or they're making sexist comments, we want to, this is like the sort of the Wild West on social media, and we want to control that more. But then on the other hand, we have this very like insidious sort of new narrative that we're also getting to grips with you know, online surveillance and you know, the NSA leaks and you know, our emails. So don't know.
It's a fascinating intellectual conundrum. Thanks very much for coming in, Heather. I just want to tell you the details of the book. The book is Literary Freedom, A Cultural Right to Literature, out in about 2 weeks' time. And the author who kindly joined us there, Heather Catherine McRoby.
We are fast approaching the end of the program, but in just a moment we'll be flicking through this morning's Italian front pages. But before we get to that, here is iSoul 8 with Waves of Love.
You are indeed listening to Midori House with me, Guy Delorne, and Phil Hahn. We're now about to leaf through today's Italian papers. That's why we had an Italian tune, of course. Mm-hmm. And for this, we're joined in, as he's just put it, my fellow French namer has just joined me in the studio, David Plaisant. Hello.
Welcome, Guy Delorne.
Bless you. Bless you, sir.
And hello, Phil. Yeah, so I thought we would start with a very complex issue on the front of most pages. This is the debate over electoral reform. I have mentioned this before. It's something that's called the pigsty parliament or pigsty government, the porcellum. These were kind of electoral reform laws brought in some years ago under Berlusconi. And ever since, basically, parliament and Senate have been trying to unpick these laws. It's immensely complex stuff, and I won't try and bore the listeners, but it seems that finally there is some progress, and this centres on a dialogue and a kind of pact that's being formed by between Letta and Renzi. Matteo Renzi is the upcoming lead, the kind of the figurehead of the PD, the centre-left party. There seemed the kind of widely reported tussle between him and Enrico Letta seems to kind of be dissolving somewhat, and some kind of pact has been kind of resolved. They're pointing kind of to a French model whereby, I mean, that would suit both of them for their own kind of political careers also, whereby Matteo Renzi would probably take kind of prime minister position and Letta might kind of, you know, become something of a presidential figure. But this is all very much vague plans. But that's what was kind of debated yesterday in Parliament.
They're going to have an almighty carve-up in the pigsty parliament then, by the sounds of it.
Exactly. But I should say that it is really kind of, it's all kind of ideas at the moment. And the session is going to recommence on the 8th of December. So we'll hear more about that pigsty parliament law.
Excellent stuff. I'm just happy that Berlusconi's not top of your list, finally, after many weeks and months of him.
I know, although
it's quite nice. nice change.
He's already kind of making comments about what they're trying to do. So
let's just not report those.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, you've got another story about the mafia in Sicily.
Yeah, that's right. Angelino Alfano, the interior minister, has said that people shouldn't be surprised or shouldn't exclude attacks by the mafia in Sicily. What he means is kind of attacks against the government and the police, throwing back to that very dark era in Sicily's history in the early 90s, where judges, very famous cases of judges being assassinated in large kind of massacres in all over the island. This is kind of quite disturbing statement from the Interior Ministry. The kind of mafia situation. People have all been looking at the 'Ndrangheta in Calabria, thinking that really the mafia situation in Sicily had somehow kind of turned a page and had become something of less of a worry. But no, according to Alfano, he, as the interior minister, wanted the press to know that there had been various kind of quite worrying threats to public prosecutor Nino Di Matteo. This comes at the release of a big boss, Toto Riina, who'd served a huge long sentence. So, I mean, it's kind of all that question of the mafia seems to be still dogging Sicily.
It's like an episode of Inspector Montalbano.
Exactly. It's very topical, very popular series that's being watched by lots of people all over Europe. But, I mean, the situation isn't all over.
Thanks very much, David. We're going to have to leave it there. Monocle's David Pleasant with some of the Italian front pages. Also, thanks to our producer, of course, Marcus Hippie, and our researchers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Rosie Sells, and, of course, our studio manager, Bill Luti. Up next, after the news, is The Menu with Marcus Hippie. And, of course, stay tuned for the briefing at midday in London. That's 7 a.m. if you're listening to us from the east coast of Canada and the United States. I'll be back with Guy for another edition of Midori House at the same time tomorrow. But for now, from me, Phil Hahn,
and me, Guy Delaunay. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Why this watch? This watch is a witness. A witness to words that moved nations. Its dead men faster, further. It's been worn by luminaries, visionaries, champions. It doesn't just tell time. It tells history. Rolex.